From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, why are the conservative Koch brothers trying to stop a transit project in Tennessee?
But first to Ukraine. American troops began military exercises in neighboring Eastern Europe today to send a message of U.S. commitment to the region. Russia is conducting its own military drills on its border with Ukraine. NPR international correspondent Eleanor Beardsley is there in Eastern Ukraine. Eleanor, first, what's been the reaction there to U.S. troops in Poland and headed to other European countries?
Oh, well, I can tell you exactly the reaction from people here. It's provocation. They love this word, but it seems that everything the U.S. does is a provocation. It just seems to be fanning the flames here. Someone today in front of the occupied town hall told me, you know, your vice president was here yesterday, and then they launched the anti-terrorist operation, and he's the one that told them to do that. America's calling all the shots. You never hear them talking like that about the European Union, and people say, why is America in our territory? We're not in your territory. So that's how they see that.
Well, and this, you're in eastern Ukraine where there's these pro-Russian activists. Is it across the board, this attitude?
You know, it's not across the board that they want to be part of Russia, or what is absolutely across the board is that I have not met anyone here who thinks the government in Kiev and that Maidan in Kiev is legitimate. I feel that people here truly believe that they talk about this group Right Sector, the neo-Nazis, the fascists. They just, you know, it's these fascists, this idea that it's a resurgence of fascism in the west of their country. Some of the less educated people really believe it. But even people educated, they just think this is a puppet junta government, and they don't see why the West is so in support of their junta government and not, you know, their wishes here. They just don't want to be told what to do by Kiev and this illegal government.
Well, Eleanor, we want to ask you about another story that's surfacing of an American journalist kidnapped, and we also saw reports of a Ukrainian journalist being led away by one of these pro-Russian, green-suited, sort of quasi-military people. What's this? Your sense of how safe journalists are?
You know, Robin, it is a little bit tense. It's not at all like working in Paris. First of all, everyone's suspicious of foreign journalists, especially American journalists. And right now we're hearing a lot of people say, Pravda, you know, Pravda, tell the truth. Please don't twist things. Tell the truth. And I asked a woman today, I said, do you believe the Russian media tells us truth? And she said, yes. But she said, the Ukrainian media doesn't. And so I talked to her about that. But the thing is, you know, you'll do an interview. First of all, some people don't want to talk to you. A man flat out told me, you're American media. He said, I can't talk to you. And here's why I can't talk to you, because you'll twist what I say. And then he apologized for not being able to talk to me. I mean, it was kind of sweet, really. But the thing is, today I was doing interviews at the occupied site. And as you interview someone, people start gathering around. You feel them behind you. You smell alcohol. And then somebody comes up. And I'm interviewing a man who was in the siege of Leningrad. He's 90 years old. And some guy comes up, a big burly guy, and asks me for my ID. And so you have to show your ID, and everyone's suspicious of you. And actually, I have a French ID in my fixer. He said, she's from Paris, and that seemed to go over a little bit better than being from America. So, yeah, it's kind of tense now.
Well, we'll leave that for now. But we know that you are trying to get at the roots, literally the roots of what's going on there in Ukraine. And while we've all seen pictures of the former president, Viktor Yanukovych's palatial home, the one that, you know, after he fled the country, overthrown, Ukrainians flooded the grounds to look at this luxury that they did not know existed there. But you visited his childhood home. Where was that, and what was that like?
It was a place called Yanakiva. It's like, let's say, an hour from Donetsk. Oh, it was a grim place, you know, just a mid-sized sort of town, and it's a steel town, and this huge belching factory with like 7 smokestacks, and everything seemed drab, these big brown housing blocks. And even my Ukrainian translator, he hated it. He said, I hate this town. And it seemed that we'd run into people who were odious the whole time. And somebody asked him, he asked directions, and they said to him, are you from Right Sector? And it was just strange. We had, and there was these young guys who were drinking, you know, the occupiers of the town hall, and they weren't very organized, and they were, you're scared of people like that, because you know, there's nobody over them. They're sort of doing what they want. So there was this feeling there that it was just as a place sort of left people there. I asked them about him stealing money, and most people would say, yes, everyone has done it. He's not the only one. It's happened for the last 20 years. And people were kind of mad. Some people were mad about it, and then others said no, he was a good president because he listened to the east of Ukraine. There's also this big thing that people believe that Kiev never listens to the east. Nobody asks their opinion. There really is seems to be a deep divide between east and west Ukraine. I've been in both places now, and they are not listening to each other. They're both going off in different directions. Yet the people in Maidan look like the people here occupying. They're the same kind of people, yet they can't be that different, I'm thinking. If only they could get together and talk. It's very worrisome, actually.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, as she said, she's been all over Ukraine, right now is in the eastern part of the country. Thanks so much, Eleanor.
Robin, great to be with you.
Now to Tennessee, where a fight over a transit system in Nashville has drawn the attention of the conservative billionaire Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch. Their lobbying organization, Americans for Prosperity, has been working with local activists to scuttle a proposed bus rapid transit project called AMP. It is the first time the Koch brothers have targeted a transit project. So why are they involved? Bobby Allen of Nashville Public Radio, WPLN, has been following this story and is with us now. Welcome, Bobby.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Well, tell us about this rapid transit project.
So there's a project called the AMP in Nashville, and it's a 7-mile stretch from east to west Nashville. It's been planned for, about 4 years now, and it's gone through several iterations, and there's been a lot of resistance from different interest groups. But the most recent thing is that state legislatures have tried to insert themselves to kind of stop the project in its tracks.
And with the help of groups like Americans for Prosperity, after the Senate passed this bill that would have made something like this illegal, they thanked Americans for Prosperity. What did AFP do?
So after the Senate in Tennessee passed a bill that would have effectively banned Tennessee's first real mass transit project in the state, people who were against the project thanked Americans for Prosperity, and everyone thought, wait a minute, Americans for Prosperity was even involved? And until that point, we didn't even know that Americans for Prosperity had any role in opposing the AMP. So when questions were asked to the senator, he said, I had several meetings with the point person for Americans Prosperity who helped him draft the legislation that would have dismantled the mass transit project here.
Why?
So they say they are against the AMP, just like they're against a variety of issues. They see it as a waste of taxpayer money. They think the project is poorly planned, and they just don't think it should go forward.
But it's one thing to come out and say we shouldn't be funding this. It's another thing to ban any projects like this from even getting off the ground.
Yeah. Now, when you talk to the Americans for Prosperity folks here, and by the way, it's a small presence, right? There's three people in Tennessee, two of whom are registered lobbyists, and they go after issues like Common Core, a tax on investment income in Tennessee. So going after transit issues doesn't really fit with what they usually attack. But when you talk to them, they say, we are against this because it's a waste of taxpayer money. And they say this was a case-specific attack. But others of observers in Tennessee say, maybe it's actually a piece of model legislation that they hope to leverage to attack mass transit projects in other states.
Well, and many people who know a lot about the Koch brothers know that Koch Industries is all about energy and oil and things that would be, I guess, in opposition to mass transit. That could be a reason why the Koch brothers would get involved in stopping a mass transit project in Tennessee.
And I have heard that before, too. They'll never come out and say that. But, they could hypothetically oppose this on two fronts. One, they're against the use of taxpayer money, which also dovetails neatly with their main form of income, which is derived from a billionaire oil company.
Well, now that the project is moving forward, despite the action of the Senate, does it mean that Americans for Prosperity and, by extension, the Koch brothers lost this battle?
Well, not exactly, because right now where the project stands is it's going to be extremely difficult to get a state contribution for the mass transit project. So planners have to come up with $35 million that is right now an open question that, planners were counting on before this legislation passed. And, construction of this mass transit project is still a year and a half off, which means there's another legislative session that we still have to get through. In which the Koch brothers will probably mount another assault against the project before we could even break ground.
Well, and we should say it's not just mass transit that the group Americans for Prosperity has gotten itself involved with in Tennessee. There's also a pledge to repeal the state's income tax that a lot of Tennessee's legislators have gotten behind, although that's not the view of the Republican governor, Bill Haslam. Let's listen to an Americans for Prosperity ad that is running in Tennessee.
Every day, some seniors have to choose between buying necessary medication or buying food. Thankfully, over 92 legislators have committed to help our seniors by repealing the Hall income tax. That's over two-thirds of the legislature. Unfortunately, Governor Haslam doesn't think our seniors should get tax relief.
Bobby, tell us more about some of the other initiatives that Americans for Prosperity has put its hands into in Tennessee.
Sure. So Americans for Prosperity, they've been fiercely against the Hall income tax, which is a tax in Tennessee on investment income. They also have come out against Common Core education standards. In Tennessee, they have opposed letting school district lobbyists use taxpayer money to lobby. There's a variety of issues that they really are strongly against, and they all come down with cutting taxes back, cutting state and federal funded infrastructure projects back. But all of the things that they oppose in Tennessee really have to do with their libertarian agenda, which is anti-tax and anti-federal spending.
And how do the people in Tennessee feel about this? You've been out speaking with people. What are they saying about all of this national money coming into what would be local initiatives, local races?
Now, there's a lot of mixed opinions on Americans for Prosperity here. Obviously, Americans for Prosperity can really thrive here, given we have a Republican governor, we have a supermajority in the state legislature. They see Tennessee as a real laboratory for test driving pieces of legislation that they maybe can try in other state legislators around the country. Now, you know, on some issues like the AMP, they're kind of a closeted political force. They don't really go out too upfront with their opposition. With other things like the Hall tax, they run radio ads across the state attacking the governor. So it really depends on the issue. Sometimes you hear a lot about them, and other times they're kind of working in the shadows, I guess.
Bobby Allen, a reporter with Nashville Public Radio, WPLN. Bobby, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks a lot.
It's Here Now, and if you just joined us, we've been hearing about how activists David and Charles Koch and one of their organizations, Americans for Prosperity, or AFP, worked with local activists in Tennessee to stop a mass transit project in Nashville. Now, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has been attacking the brothers for what he sees as their undermining public policy. One of them, Charles, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal defending what he called good citizenship. NPR's Peter Overby has been looking at the power of money and influence in politics. Let's bring him in for a couple of thoughts. And Peter, remind us how widespread the Koch organization is.
The Koch's political organization is kind of the sprawling, diffuse group of organizations that are clustered around a couple of main funding groups. And the Center for Responsive Politics in the Washington Post did probably the best tracking job. And they counted 28 groups active in 2012 that had financial connections to the Koch brothers and their core organization. One of the interesting things about it is that Americans for Prosperity got about $15 million through this network that I just described. And in contrast, they spent $38 million in 2012 just on ads attacking President Obama. So there is a lot of money coming into Americans for Prosperity from sources other than this network. A lot of it is grassroots money. AFP has a significant grassroots organization. They claim they have 2.3 million activists, as they say, not members, and they claim 90,000 donors. So you had money coming in that way. Then you have money coming in other ways, too, probably. We don't know because AFP is a social welfare organization, not a political organization, so it doesn't disclose its donors.
Well, as we just heard, in Tennessee, there is suspicion, probably mostly on the part of those who back mass transit, that this was just a test ground for legislation that can be taken across the state. Where else in your looking around do you see Koch Brothers money going?
There was money that went through this network, wound up at the National Rifle Association in 2012. Americans for Tax Reform, which is, you know, a long-established anti-tax group in D.C. 60 Plus, which is a 501c4 that runs ads attacking the Affordable Care Act and is active in a lot of congressional campaigns. So there are lots of entities where money from this organization winds up.
Well, but as Charles Koch said in his op-ed, I am devoting my life to understanding principles that enable people to improve their lives, and that he has the right to do that. He's being a good citizen, putting his money where his ideals are. And we always hear, Peter, from people who say, well, how is this any different from George Soros, who supports Democratic candidates? So How is it different?
Well, the first way it's different is that George Soros was a really major player in partisan politics in 2004. Since then, he's certainly been involved, but he has not spent tens of millions of dollars in party politics the way that we've seen the Kochs do. So that's one difference. The issue for all of the millionaires and billionaires that are playing in politics is that they do it through 501c4 groups, social welfare organizations, other entities where their contributions are not disclosed.
You see something else happening. We've been hearing about the Koch brothers for years. But do you think that the Democrats actually now see what the Koch brothers are doing as an advantage?
The Democrats have been touching on the Kochs as a political issue, trying to make them an issue since 2010, when the Citizens United ruling came down from the Supreme Court that opened up a lot of the opportunities for this kind of spending. And they have gotten very aggressive about it in the past year. Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, has been attacking the Kochs regularly on the Senate floor. The Republicans are up in arms about this, and it's really unusual for a member of Congress to single out individual private citizens for this kind of commentary. But the Democrats think there's an advantage to it. They think that, you know, if they can make the Kochs a symbol, Republicans' attachment to the wealthiest Americans, the 1%, if you will, then that will play to their advantage. That will play to the Democrats' advantage in the election. The problem they have is that when pollsters go out, they find that most people don't know who the Kochs are. You know, that even after all this talk, they haven't really got this to stick in voters' minds.
Peter Overby, NPR's Power of Money and Influence correspondent. Fascinating. Peter, thank you so much.
I'm glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
And a sensitive topic now, maybe not for kids' ears. The Supreme Court decided today in a case questioning just how much someone convicted of viewing child pornography must pay to the victims in the pictures. Courts in various states have awarded payment to victims, but a federal appeals court in New Orleans ordered Texan Doyle Randall Paroline to pay over $3.4 million to a woman known in court papers as Amy. And today the Supreme Court threw out that judgment, saying there is a limit on how much victims can recover from one person convicted of looking at images. Now, we spoke about this case before it went to the highest court. We'll post our reporting at hereandnow.org, but let's bring in David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, on today's ruling. So, David, what else did the court say when they overturned in the majority this judgment?
Well, I think the judgment is sort of a middle ground decision, and strikes me as sort of more good news than bad for victims of child pornography, because the court said, If you're a victim, you can collect money from every person who is caught viewing these illegal images. But you can't collect a single amount, $3.5 million, from one of these people. So it sort of puts the courts on notice, U.S. attorneys around the country, that they've got to go after these people and collect money from them, maybe $5,000, $10,000. Not $1 million.
Yeah, but as we heard when we spoke with a lawyer for one of these women, that means that they have to. There's millions of people viewing these images around the world. That means that for the rest of their lives, they have to be involved in court cases. So that was the argument against that. But we understand that the court also said that Paroline, the man convicted of viewing the images, can be required to pay a reasonable amount. Who gets to decide that?
A federal judge.
Yeah, so this will go back to a lower court.
Yes. The good thing from the victim's point of view, though, is the U.S. attorneys are supposed to handle this. In other words, the victims don't have to go into court themselves and carry on all this litigation. The federal prosecutors are supposed to do it. And as you said, a federal judge is now going to decide on the right amount.
Yeah. Well, we know that Chief Justice John Roberts, Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas dissented from the majority ruling. They said Congress failed to make clear how judges should decide on damages. Sonia Sotomayor dissented separately. She wants the defendant to pay the full amount. But we understand others are saying to Congress, change the law, make it so that there can be more restitution.
I think it's possible somebody might go back to Congress. But it seems to me the court set out a way for these cases to proceed, because judges can decide this. If they've got a person there who's been convicted, they can say this person can easily pay $5,000 or $10,000. So I think for now,
yeah,
I think the court set up a system that might work.
David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. On a Supreme Court decision, this seems to be Supreme Court decision week, overturning a huge payment required from someone convicted of viewing child pornography images, but as David said, opening the way for a lower payment. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, HBO announced a partnership with Amazon to stream some of its content for Amazon Prime subscribers. This would be the first time that viewers could watch HBO content without a cable subscription, which could be interpreted as lose one for cable, win one for the cloud. Joining us from Silicon Valley is someone who's been doing a lot of reporting on the cloud for NPR, NPR's technology correspondent, Steve Henn. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
Well, I want to get to some of your reporting on the cloud in a moment. But first of all, what can you tell us about this HBO deal and what it means?
Well, you know, it's a huge win for Amazon. You know, many young people, lots of families are looking for ways to avoid paying huge cable fees and get the content they love. So for Amazon to be able to offer its subscribers to Amazon Prime, you know, streaming access to The Sopranos, to The Wire, and other HBO content is a big win for Amazon. It's also a blow to cable providers and Netflix, which obviously would have loved to have this deal. You know, for years now, Hollywood has gotten pretty savvy in playing big internet providers off of each other and forcing them to compete for rights to these shows, to the most watched content out there. And this is another example of them doing that successfully.
Well, let's talk about Amazon, because I imagine when we talk about the cloud, there's got to be few players as big or bigger than Amazon.
Right. Amazon is enormous. By some estimates, Amazon is five times larger in terms of server capacity than the next 14 competitors in the cloud combined. I mean, it's just huge. And one of the reasons it's so big is that it got a head start in this business. Really, before anyone else, Amazon recognized that it would be much cheaper for web startups to rent server space from a company like Amazon than to buy their own servers. So right now, Netflix, Pinterest, Dropbox, and tons of other tech companies depend on Amazon's machines.
And there are concerns about those machines and the environmental impact of them, these big farms where cloud computing is. It's not in the air, of course. It's right there on the ground. You visited. Tell us about it.
Right. I mean, the scale of cloud computing is pretty staggering. I mean, when you hear the term the cloud, you know, you tend to think of something that's like white and fluffy and clean. And in reality, it's anything but. I mean, these are industrial scale facilities that use enormous amounts of electricity. So I visited one in Santa Clara in the heart of Silicon Valley, and the building was a quarter of a mile long, roughly the size of the Nimitz aircraft carrier. And just the amount of electricity is kind of mind-boggling. Half of the facility uses 57,000 homes, typical homes worth of power. And if they lose air conditioning in the facility, they have a tank, a water tank, that holds 500,000 gallons of water. This thing was eight stories high.
Wow.
And they would evaporate that water to cool the computers inside the machine. And all of that water, if the computers were running at full capacity, would be gone in a half an hour. And you know, a facility like that can't lose power for even a second. So they have this system of flywheels, seven-ton wheels that are rotating in place at 390 miles an hour. They have 16 of these things. And if they lose connectivity to the grid and lose power, those wheels convert their kinetic energy into electricity. That powers the facility for just 12 seconds. I mean, it's mind-blowing.
Fascinating. NPR technology correspondent Steve Henn. And you can find more of his reporting on the cloud at our website, hereandnow.org. Steve, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, this week, dozens of coffee shop employees will step out from behind the counter to stand in front of judges. They're heading to Seattle to compete in coffee competitions, from brewing to roasting to putting intricate designs in the milk on top of a latte. It's the Coffee Olympics. Gabe Bullard reports from Here and Now contributing station WFPL that two Kentuckians are hoping to bring top honors back to a state known more for bourbon than baristas.
It's a rainy Thursday at the University of Louisville. And though the campus coffee shop is closed, Michael Butterworth is still working. He's a barista at Quill's Coffee, and he's assembled four of his peers at the shop counter. Another stands behind him. They're all holding clipboards and meticulously taking notes as he moves from the grinder to the espresso machine and back, presenting them with drinks for review.
I'm also using a homemade rhubarb syrup to accentuate those rhubarb notes.
Butterworth is practicing the routine he'll do at the National Barista Competition. It's a 15-minute presentation that includes a conversation about the coffee he's serving and the brewing of an espresso, a cappuccino, and a signature drink for each judge, played here by his friends and colleagues. Afterward, the judges compare notes.
I definitely picked up the tangerine bitterness, the plum as well, and maybe it's I just don't really have a good handle on what rhubarb tastes like.
Butterworth will be up against 35 of the best baristas in the country in the national competition, each with their own 15-minute routines. But the barista competition is just one event in Seattle, and Butterworth won't be the only Louisvillian going for gold. James Toole, a roaster with Louisville-based Argo Sons Coffee, will be competing too.
I'm going to the National Brewers Cup, which is sort of like a best cup of coffee competition.
The judges compare more than just taste and appearance. They get into what can best be described as the entire sensory experience of drinking coffee. So the competitors have been training, making cup after cup of coffee and comparing notes with colleagues. To raise money for the pounds of coffee he goes through in training and the other expenses of the competition, Quills organized a latte art contest before Butterworth's practice run.
All right, guys, Butterworth moves on.
Baristas from across the region paid a few dollars to compete, with two area aficionados judging patterns the baristas drew on the drinks with milk and coffee.
This one is well-centered. The outer leaves have a good wraparound.
About 20 people compare notes and generally nerd out over cups of coffee and milk. It's not a scene you expect to see in Kentucky, but everyone says Louisville's food culture and devotion to craft beverages, like bourbon, make this the perfect breeding ground for coffee obsessives. And a victory from a local barista will legitimize the scene. A good showing for Toole or Butterworth is a good showing for Louisville. And Quills manager Matthew Stevenson says it will help the shop, too.
Putting a barista on the national stage is going to be huge for us, both as like wholesale coffee company and just as a brand.
The individual winner of the National Barista Competition gets entry into the international competition and a gold espresso tamper. They also get a shot at making their hobby their career. Butterworth studied English, and he got started in coffee while teaching in Turkey. He used to take weekend trips to cafes across Europe. But without a win, it'll be hard to stay in this new field.
Somebody asked my wife what I did for a living, and when she said a barista, he said, "What is he, a student?" You know, there's just kind of this general cultural ethos that being a barista isn't a real job.
But not everyone shares Butterworth's enthusiasm. A few feet away, Keisha Lockhart is hanging out.
I don't know, I think it's weird. It's just coffee.
Toole is used to criticism like that, but he says these contests matter, even if you're not drinking championship-level coffee.
I personally feel the same way about, like, fashion shows, right? It's like, it's making a big deal about a slightly different cut, but, like, those fashion shows, like, really affect everything that ends up like, at every store. That's the professional world of fashion.
So whatever Toole and Butterworth brew up at the competition, it's likely to trickle down, or drip, to your morning cup sometime soon. For Here and Now, I'm Gabe Bullard in Louisville, Kentucky.
More than 150 bodies have now been recovered from that submerged ferry off the South Korean coast. As you know, many of the dead high schoolers on their way to the holiday island of Jeju when the ship listed sharply and sank. Almost an entire graduating class is gone. The captain and several crew members are now in custody. BBC correspondent Lucy Williamson went to Jeju to meet a survivor.
At Jeju Harbor today, ferries unloaded their meager passengers, just a handful of them on one ship. This holiday island, with its beaches and volcanoes, was where the Sewol's journey was meant to end. A treat for teenagers before their final school year. They never saw it. Just before 9 a.m. last Wednesday, traffic controllers here picked up their boat's distress call. Workers at the ferry company here on shore were rushed into the office, but there was little they could do. One of them, who was here that day, told me he can't even walk down the street now without people blaming him. His colleagues on board, he says, should have done more. At the hospital, we find Eun Soo Choi, a truck driver who was on board the ship. He'd made that journey hundreds of times. At 9 o'clock that morning, he'd just had breakfast and gone up on the deck for a smoke.
All of a sudden, the ship tilted and started to sink. Containers started to fall off into the sea, and I realized we were going to capsize. I was clinging on to the handrail.
As the ship listed further, he and a friend tried to save some of the students stuck inside.
I tried to save some of the students in the cafeteria. They were sliding on their knees around the cashier's desk. I threw them a fire hose, but the boat was tilting too much. And then the water started coming in. My friend managed to save a 6-year-old child who was trapped inside. I think the parents and others inside were the heroes. They were passing the child to each other over their heads. By the time my friend was holding her, the ship was capsizing, and all those people were swept away in the water. That's the most painful memory I have. Those students and those parents were the bravest people of all.
Just across the water in Jindo, recovery teams are now bringing in the bodies. No miracles here now, just the joyless reunions of families with their dead.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson, reporting from Jeju, South Korea.
Time now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. There goes the last DJ. Travis Holcomb joins us as he often does. He's DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Travis, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Jeremy.
And even though you are in Southern California, you've got some European music to tell us about. Let's start in Norway with Todd Terrier, and the song is called Leisure Suit Preben. Well, I can definitely see this being Norwegian, Travis, but who is Todd Terrier?
So Todd Terrier is a guy that he's been around for about a decade, but he's mostly known as sort of a dance music producer. He got to start re-editing old disco records by groups like Chic and the Bee Gees. And then he started evolving into doing his own productions, and he's sort of been like the underground dance music king, I would say, for like the past 4 years. He's just had like an incredible string of singles. And he's pretty much done everything. He's worked with Franz Ferdinand. He's released a whole bunch of 12-inch singles that have been huge. And sort of the final frontier for Todd Terrier was to release a full-length album, which he just recently did. And the album is called It's Album Time. And it sort of threw everyone for a curve a little bit because, you know, he's got a lot more of a lounge and exotica sound than anyone expected from his full length.
Yeah, let's listen to another one from him. This is Johnny and Mary featuring Brian Ferry. Running around. I feel like I'm in the Breakfast Club, Travis. Or listening to Bruce Springsteen, maybe, also.
Yeah, I mean, like, Brian Ferry's got this weathered presence now, it seems like. That song just feels, I don't know, just very... It seems like it delves into some deeper meanings than it may have if it was a younger singer doing the lyrics.
What about the sound do you think catches your ear? What got you into Todd Terrier?
Well, he's got this one song called Inspector Norris that was sort of like the track that put him on the map. And he's just, I don't know, he's got an ear for really poppy melodies. Have to necessarily be into house music at all, but it'll just grab you and make you want to move your feet. He's just got a very good pop sensibility.
Okay, well, let's stay in Norway and get to another artist named Tug. And I might need some of your help pronouncing the name of this song. It is Narmi Vakni Op Imara, which actually means when I wake up tomorrow, which is funny because they sort of sound like they're the same thing. But let's listen. There was a moment there right at the beginning when I thought that the song was in English, but it is most certainly not.
No, it's definitely not. And that's one of the things I really like about Tug is all of their songs are in Norwegian, which, you know, most Norwegian groups choose to, you know, at least the ones that cross over into the States will sing in English. So it was kind of refreshing to be able to hear a whole album in Norwegian. I have no idea what they're singing about. I mean, I know, like you said, that song translates into When I Wake Up Tomorrow, but other than that, I don't know what he's saying, and I kind of like not knowing.
Let's listen to another one from Tug. This is Ild Jord Luftbach. Travis, you have done a very good job in transporting us to some sort of discoteca in Europe.
It seems like Norway, they either go one way or the other. It's either like you go black metal or you go like really fun disco pop.
Well, let's get to France because maybe we'll get a different sound from France. This is the artist Catherine. The song is Pas Tout Seul. Travis, who is Catherine?
So Catherine, he's an artist that's been around since the early 90s, but he really kind of broke out in 2005. He had an album that was on the French charts for 2 years, which is incredible to think about. Like, when you think about American artists that have done that on American charts, it might be like Adele and Katy Perry. So he is like a superstar in France, but he's basically unknown here in the States, and he just released a new album. It's called Magnum, and it's just full of songs like we just heard, just sort of like disco, pop, fun kind of stuff.
Well, let's hear a little more of that. Okay, Travis, we have time for one more, and it is the Parisian duo Jamaica. Here is the song Two on Two. Hello, what you just see, I can hear you say, out of my reach, words keep flowing in, and never ask for better homes, coming to walls when it's still small, you're just a princess who holds that she knows the right guy. Release the beat. Okay, overarching question here, Travis. How on earth do you find this stuff?
I just dig through a lot of stuff. I listen to a lot of crap to get to the golden nuggets in there.
Well, tell us a little bit about Jamaica.
So Jamaica, this is their second album. They're, you know, as you heard, they kind of have a similar sound to groups like Phoenix or The Strokes.
Yeah.
I actually hear a lot of Cars and not necessarily in that song so much as some of the other tracks on the album. But yeah, this is their second album and it's called Ventura.
Well, are you going to be taking any trips to Paris or Oslo anytime soon, Travis?
I wish I was. No, unfortunately, no.
You'll just have to suffer in Santa Monica. That must be very difficult.
Yeah.
Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Thanks, as always.
All right. Thanks, J-Hop.